We'll continue with part two of this talk with Tyler Davis.
Well, I'm really glad to see that somebody's interested in benefit-cost analysis first thing in the morning. So I'm glad that you asked that question. We will get to it, and it has to do with whether you're accounting for regional economic development or national economic development. Under which account are you evaluating the project in total? And of course, there is a moral hazard because people that are advocating for local projects are going to want to have the accounts limited strictly to the area in which they have jurisdiction. And then the Army Corps is mandated that has to evaluate projects on a national economic development level. So there's definitely some interplay between that. But I'd like to thank Julie for giving us the background on the benefit cost analysis in the Army Corps and some of the history of how it's progressed so far. The overview for this portion of the talk is I'm going to review how might benefit cost analysis be improved in the principles and guidelines. And we're going to identify the existing criticisms in the literature. The first two, these are theoretical criticisms and possible revisions. Secondly, we're going to look at what are special considerations for floodplains. These are, again, theoretical, and these are also drawn from the existing literature. And then finally, we're going to look at how the principles and guidelines were applied to the Upper Mississippi River Comprehensive Plan. This is our empirical review of an actual Army Corps of Engineer project and study using the principles and guidelines. The criticisms and revisions to the principles and guidelines came from three major sources. Major criticisms came from the National Research Council, the EPA, which developed their independent principles and guidelines for benefit-cost analysis and have an implicit criticism for the way that the Army Corps handles it. And the Army Corps itself, individuals within it, comment. The revisions come from agency regulations. These are Army Corps circulars. As Julie mentioned, they're binding for 2 years, after which they can either be codified, and then they'll be binding in the planning guidance notebook, or they're dropped, and also federal legislation. Obviously, the congressional branch has the opportunity to review and revise the principles and guidelines. And finally, the Army Corps is conducting its own independent review of the principles and guidelines. You saw this in the 2008 new draft principles, which were under the preceding administration and were dropped completely when the new administration took over. But they went ahead and did a review of the principles and guidelines again, and in December 3rd of 2009, released 4 new draft principles. And so the internal review is ongoing. The principal criticisms, and these are the 5 theoretical criticisms that we're going to view, are national versus regional accounting, planning area, environmental quality, public safety, and uncertainty and risk. And we'll go over each of these in turn. First, national versus regional accounting. This is the question that was just asked. Now, the NED, or National Economic Development account, is heavily weighted relative to other accounts. In fact, it's the decision driving criteria. This is how the Army Corps must choose which projects it moves forward with. And to recap what Julie said, you have a proposed project, you identify maybe 5 to 10 or 15 different options, you evaluate them based on the 4 different accounts, and then you rank those. One of the options has to be an NED maximizing option, and the Army Corps has to go with the option which maximizes the national economic development. Now, the criticism is that you're not incorporating other elements of the 4 accounts. These are the environmental quality account, the other social effects account, and the regional economic development account. And options, of course, we presented this to the Congressional Research Service, and so they ask us to present options as opposed to recommendations. So when you're talking to a congressional policymaker, you give them an alternative, and they can choose to take it or not. So an option would be to identify cost-sharing mechanisms between the region, which conducts the regional economic development, and the nation. So you could have the possibility of each side having a positive benefit-cost ratio, depending on how costs are split. Secondly, you could require the other accounts, RED, EQ, or OSC, to be weighed in using some algorithm to determine what would maximize the what would be the best thing for the country out of all the options. And another option would be to use benefit-cost analysis methods to account for distributional effects, i.e., if you have disadvantaged groups or advantaged groups that are disproportionately impacted by different policy options. So the take-home message from this is that The Army Corps identifies many different ways of accounting, and it's complex. And simply limiting it to the National Economic Development account is limiting the options for policymakers. Second criticism is the definition of planning area. How the planning area is defined and managed by the planners affects benefit-cost analysis. Now, the concept here is that you have a planning area and an affected area. The planning area is the area in which the benefit-cost analysis is conducted. The affected area actually may exceed that, and so you could have an analysis done at an upstream town, but there could have an impact which was felt in downstream towns. And if the risk-cost curve for a downstream town were increased, then you wouldn't be incorporating that into your benefit-cost analysis in general. So the local versus regional definitions of affected area differ, and they can have an impact on the benefit-cost ratio and actually can have an impact on whether or not the project goes forward. Options include what's called an upstream-downstream analysis, which is incorporating the impacts of upstream projects on areas that are downstream. For example, if you raise a levee from a 100-year level of protection to a 500-year level of protection upstream, then the water that would have gone into the soil there or flooded is now going downstream, and you may have effectively decreased the level of protection of levees downstream and, in effect, raise the cost curve there. So the take-home point is that incorporating the planning area and the affected area to be the same thing would incorporate more of the benefits and costs of proposed projects. Next, environmental quality. Environmental effects and ecosystem services are difficult to quantify or value in benefit-cost analysis. This is true. It's been true since we've been doing benefit-cost analysis, since the principles and standards of 1973. Major criticisms here are the same as if they've been for quite some time. There's no strong guidance on how to quantify and monetize environmental effects. Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that we identified or that even there exists in the literature the silver bullet to how to monetize and quantify environmental effects to do cost-benefit analysis. But I will say that the Army Corps could use newer methods, ecosystem services, total economic evaluation, or they could at least give some guidance about how to include those in the NED account or how to weigh the EQ account equally with the NED account when evaluating projects. So require the EQ analysis to be incorporated into the decision framework. And it's obviously difficult to make comparisons between accounts and within the EQ account. So the summary of this criticism and option is that it's hard to quantify ecosystem services, but the Army Corps needs to give some guidelines and some guidance if it wants ecosystem services to be included in cost-benefit analysis. Public safety. Now, this is a graphic. I'm afraid you can't see it very well, but it's from O'Connor and Costa, 2004, and it shows that on average from 1950 to 2004, there's over 100 deaths of flooding, due to flooding in the United States. And people matter. Public health matters. And it certainly matters to decision makers and policy makers. And so incorporating health and safety reporting in the principles and guidelines could incorporate this additional cost into benefit of cost analysis and could actually change some projects that maybe have a low NED account but have a positive impact on public safety and make those proposed projects move forward. Options include non-monetized health and safety effects in required accounts, which aren't currently required to be reported, or the use methods of BCA and various different econometric methods for evaluating that and monetizing health and safety impacts. Now, these are controversial. Value of statistical life, quality-adjusted value of statistical life. No congressman wants to be told, you know, a constituent of yours is worth $500,000 or $5 million. I mean, nobody wants to be told themselves that you're only worth $5 million, or maybe $500,000, but including that some way in the principles and guidelines will allow you to account for that in the decision-making framework. So the take-home message of this criticism is that public safety is important and it should be included in some way into benefit-cost analysis. I mean, for goodness sake, this is how the Army Corps decides which projects to move forward with. The next major area of criticisms is the treatment of uncertainty and risk. Analysis can provide benefit-cost information as probabilities and not point estimates to better account for risk. The major criticism is that as the principles and guidelines of 1983 are written, the analysis is focused on point estimates. And there's a big difference between saying there's a 35% chance that the flood, that the levee is going to break, and I'm 95% confident, plus or minus 5%, that it's about 35%. And so what you're giving a probability distribution is actually a great deal more information, and it gives the decision maker more tools and informs them about what is likely to happen. Options for that include using probability distributions, Monte Carlo simulations, bootstrap, jackknife, imputation methods have been developed since 1983, and you can do them on I could do them on this laptop. And you also consider output pricing. That's a price elasticity of demand for goods that are used in core projects, and then identify distributions of risk. So the major criticism is that we can do a better job of communicating what is risky and how risky it is in Army Corps projects. So those were our five theoretical overall criticisms to the principles and guidelines. Now we'll look at three different specific considerations for floodplains. And this is because the WSDA, the Water Resources Development Act of 2007, specifically required that the Congressional Research Service look at floodplain criticisms to the principles and guidelines. And this is due in part to the 1993, 2007 floods in the Upper Mississippi, and obviously Katrina. So I'd like to begin with this quote from Brigadier General Gerald Galloway, and it was from his address to the American Association for the Advancement of Science of 2007. "Let no one believe that because you're behind a levee, you're safe." And this is it's a great quote, because what I think it encapsulates is that just because you have a levee doesn't mean that the risk cost curve is now zero. So to look at this visually, I have this graphic here, and on the y-axis we have risk, and on the x-axis we have the different types of risk reduction tools that are available to the Army Corps. At the highest level, you have the initial risk, and then you can have an intervention such as zoning, building codes, outreach, evacuation plans, insurance, each which diminish the risk. And at the far right, you have the imposition of a levy. Yet at the very end of the x-axis, there's still some residual risk. And this is the point, that incorporating the residual risk that remains to infrastructure that is built behind levees will actually rationalize benefit-cost analysis and bring true costs or true risk-cost curves into the evaluation of proposed projects. So the take-home is, you're not safe just because you're behind a levee. I mean, you wouldn't think that you'd have to say that post-Katrina, but in benefit-cost analysis, it is something that bears being said. Next is the inclusion of non-structural alternatives. The Corps could require a plan which primarily employs non-structural alternatives, and those are many of the things that we saw in the risk reduction graphic from the preceding slide, things such as flood awareness, flood forecasting, recovery plans, and zoning and relocation. Many times what you're doing here is actually lowering the construction cost curve. So you're lowering your total cost without affecting the risk cost curve, just by taking advantage of options which aren't traditional core levee, diking, and damming alternatives. So the take-home is, the Corps is a huge institution, and if you want something to be done, codifying it and requiring it is a good way to make sure that it is going to get done. Including non-structural alternatives as one of the different options that you identify when looking at a proposed project is one way that you could require you could explore lower cost alternatives. Finally, this is something that we've probably been talking about for 50 years. Remove subsidies and incentives to build in risky areas. So I think this is a portion of non-structural alternatives, but it's so important. I love these two pictures, because you can see on the right where the levee is holding water out from infrastructure. And what I would view this is a potentially very high risk cost curve. Those were our two different types of theoretical examples. Now we're going to look at our empirical example, which was how are the principles and guidelines applied to the Upper Mississippi River Comprehensive Plan. And the case study area
was the Upper Mississippi covers five states, and the Water Resources Development Act of 1999 authorized the review of this project. It's been reviewed, I think it's been proposed four or five times at different under different Water Resources Development Acts, usually by congressmen that are from this area. 14 alternative plans were identified. These included a no-action plan, a non-structural alternative plan, a structural alternatives. But out of all the 14 plans, the benefit-cost ratios were between 0.03 and 0.07. Now, you probably recall what Julie said, which is that you want benefit-cost ratios of 1 and above. So basically, you're getting 3 cents or 7 cents back on your dollar. And also, this was conducted at the reconnaissance level. There's two different levels of Army Corps studies. The planning area, in these different alternatives, upstream and downstream effects were identified. Plans A, D, and G had impacts on the lower Mississippi, and Plan M had public hearings. When we reviewed the testimony by the different stakeholders at these public hearings, they were typical of upstream downstream conflicts. The people upstream wanted to build levees, and the people downstream said, "Don't build levees because then we'll flood." Or the people downstream said, "You know, we'd like the federal government to purchase our land and let water flood here." And people upstream said, "No, we'd like them to purchase our land instead." And so this was kind of the not my backyard conflict that was typical of public comment in trade-offs between upstream and downstream conflicts. And the treatment of the environmental quality was very interesting in this case study. The EQ account is not required for decision making, and I think this was reflected in the quality of the analysis, which was that it only conducted a very preliminary assessment, only secondary data, and this was a multi-million-dollar, 10-year-long study, and it had a mix of monetized and non-monetized values in the account. But of course, as you remember from Julie, monetized values are supposed to go to the NED account. They weren't in this case. Other environmental impacts were discussed, but not quantified or included in the EQ account. So in the text of the, I think it was about 350-page document, it identified environmental impacts, but because these aren't driving decisions, they weren't put it in the account so that you could review the 14 different options side by side. Also, the Upper Mississippi case study had a risk analysis in the form of the risk-informed decision framework, which was a decision-making framework they borrowed from New Orleans. And what I think this shows is that the line officers of the Army Corps are incorporating a lot of these options that identified in the theoretical conclusions or the theoretical criticisms into the analysis. And what I think it's indicative of is that the officers are identifying ways that the principles and guidelines could be updated to reflect some of these more modern practices. And also they identified a non-structural alternative, which was great. So to conclude here, we looked at what are the current benefit cost analysis practices, and then we looked at criticisms and possible options to rectify those. And then we briefly looked at a case study where we saw how the Army Corps actually used the principles and guidelines for cost benefit analysis. And we had five general considerations, which were national versus regional accounting. And the recommendation was to include costs and benefits in proper accounts, environmental quality. And an option would be to include ecosystem services and other non-monetary benefits appropriately. Planning areas, make planning areas and affected areas the same thing. Public safety, account for public safety in benefit cost analysis, and communicate risk in ranges and confidence intervals. For flood specific considerations, we wanted the inclusion of non-structural alternatives, treatment of risk included in the presentation to decision makers, and to discourage development behind levees. So in conclusion, this was a great opportunity for us to work with the Congressional Research Service to update the science and economics of BCA, and we used the Upper Mississippi River to provide examples for innovative methods and actually saw how some innovative methods were being developed by the officers, which actually preceded the mandate by the Army Corps. And as I think we've seen from the 1973 Principles and Standards, 1983 Principles and Guidelines, the 2008 new draft principles and then the 2009 new draft principles. Now, just like last year, just like 10 years ago, just like 20 years ago, is a great time to be studying benefit-cost analysis in the Army Corps. Of course, we have to conclude with future research questions, which are, how should BCA process be evaluated? How should climate change be included in benefit-cost analysis? And when is BCA the appropriate tool? Thank you.
One in the back.
Yes, are your studies available somewhere?
The question is, where can we get a hold of this riveting research? The answer is that Julie and I are both here, and I believe it's on the benefit-cost analysis website hosted by the Evans School under Dr. Zerbe. You can come and talk to me, of course, and I would be happy to send you a copy of the document. Also, it should be hosted on the benefit-cost analysis website at the University of Washington, which is run by Professor Dick Zerbe. The question is, do the principles and guidelines cover ongoing maintenance costs and life cycle costs of Army Corps infrastructure? The answer to that is no. These principles and guidelines are for new proposed projects. And so this is the system, the principles and guidelines, and then the planning guidance notebook that Army Corps officers go through when evaluating new proposed projects and identifying alternatives and evaluating those.
So what about non-stationary risks? We have changing flood risk, or we have other policies that ultimately erode those benefits. And I think historically you see that. That cycle of moving people into the floodplain, which creates then benefits of protecting them, which relieves more infrastructure. So it's, you know, there's this cycle. But you know, how these improvements deal with those benefits?
The question is, how can the principles and guidelines be used to evaluate risk which changes over time, if that's a good summary? One thing we didn't mention is the so-called levee effect. You build the levee, understood risk cost curve is flat, and so people move in infrastructure, shopping malls, et cetera, et cetera. The answer to that is that, of course, when you're not doing a dynamic analysis, you're going to have an opportunity to review the project and then make recommendations to go forward or not. You can't very well review a project, move forward, and then decide that you shouldn't have done that. Well, it doesn't really help the planning process at that point. The best thing to do is to anticipate what the change in risks are going to be, the so-called levee effect, when you're conducting your benefit-cost analysis of the proposed projects in the first place. So, and then the Army Corps working with they can't change federal law, they can't change FEMA, they can't change the floodplain insurance program, but they can work with local municipalities to discourage incentives and subsidies to move into areas that have high-risk cost curves. So the answer is, very good question, there is no answer. There's not an answer in this talk, anyway. Yes?
CEQ released a new revised proposed principles and standards in December. To what extent did they incorporate the kinds of changes in the process?
So the excellent question was, the Center of Environmental Quality released a review of the principles and standards that have four specific recommendations for changes, and those were to make co-equal goals of the different accounts, which is to say not have the NED be the required decision-making account, but incorporate the other social effects, environmental quality, and regional economic development. Any mathematician in the room here or statistician will probably tell you that you can't simultaneously maximize variables that have negative relationships. So that's going to be a policy challenge. The second is to include health and human safety in benefit-cost analysis. That's something that we reviewed and we identified and we brought to the Congressional Research Service. It's not, we didn't invent that. That was something that's been an ongoing criticism. The third was to encourage good governance and transparency in the decision-making process. That actually wasn't something that we saw a lot of in the criticisms of the principles and standards. And the fourth one, Julie?
Transparency.
I already said transparency.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember what the fourth one was. Those are being reviewed by the Army Corps. I think it was released in December. They have 90 days of public comment. I think you have a little bit of a window left to make a public comment if you want. It's on the White House website. And then it's going to be reviewed by the Army Corps and the National Research Council. And then those recommendations will go back up the policy chain, and new standards and guidelines will be created to match those new mandated principles.
And just to further emphasize, these are just the principles. They still haven't established what the guidelines are, which is really where the rubber hits the road. And so deciding these are great ideas, these are great principles, but how then are those implemented is an ongoing process, and there's still public comments, and I'm sure there'll be multiple iterations of the document. So if you're interested, you can definitely make comments and be more involved.
And I don't think that 90 days is the limit to public comment, because you better believe there's going to be multiple iterations of changing the principles of benefit-cost analysis for four different federal water agencies.
I think we'll end the questions there. And I just say that in your spare time, there's a local project called Replacement of the Alaskan Way Viaduct and the Proposed Deep Bore Tunnel that I'm sure several local elected officials would appreciate your input on, or such a process on.